Hello, welcome back to Talking to Grandma. I'm your host, Dr. Veronica Benavides. Today we have a really special bonus episode from Forum, public radio station KQED. Forum tells remarkable and true stories about who we are and where we live. In February, I got to chat with Forum hosts Alexis Madrigal and Karen Garcia, a reporter with the Los Angeles Times. We dove deep into a conversation about reclaiming heritage languages and heard stories from callers in the San Francisco Bay Area. As our listeners well know, trying to preserve heritage languages in a monolingual society is hard. For decades, languages have been lost for the sake of survival by many newcomers in the U.S. Now, there is a generational readiness to reclaim what was lost. But where do we begin? We are thrilled to bring this Forum episode to our Talking to Grandma listeners today. You are in for a treat. Be sure to check out the show notes from today's episode and follow and subscribe to Forum on your favorite podcast platform. They touch on topics that are relevant to Californians and beyond, from imposter syndrome to how to make some of life's biggest decisions. I'm a big fan of theirs and hope you check them out too. Now on to the show.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. The Bay Area has families from all over the world. Our ancestors spoke many different languages, and some of us have carried on those linguistic traditions here in the U.S. But what about those of us who don't still speak Espanol, or at least don't speak it like we want to, or feel like we should, or that others expect us to? As you can tell from that last sentence, learning a heritage language as they're known gets complicated fast. You got to deal not just with conjugation, but colonization, not just adjectives, but assimilation. And really at the root of it all, for most of us, there's pain. The pain of lives you never got to live, but might have, had things gone a different way. So let's talk. This one's personal. Bring your baggage. It's all coming up next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Or should I be saying, welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. It's a question that one of my colleagues here at KQED, Mario, has asked me. I don't totally have the answer. Really, he actually busts my chops about it. But I didn't grow up speaking Spanish past the age of 3 when my family moved back from Mexico City to California. I've heard my name like that from my family and many others, especially since Encanto came out. But in my daily life, I've just never really said it like that. Yet now, I think about this almost every day when we open this show, because it is tied in deep to my identity as a Mexican-American, as a Mexican, as an American, as a Chicano, as a Latino, and what my broken Spanish says about all those identities. Of course, I know I'm not alone in any of this. There are literally millions of us here who know the kinds of prevarications and self-recriminations I'm describing, whether you're thinking about Spanish or Vietnamese, Urdu or Cantonese, Farsi or Mam. And here to help us work through all this heritage language complexity, we're joined by Karen Garcia, reporter on the utility journalism team with the Los Angeles Times, who's the author of the recent article, How Second and Third Generation Latinos Are Reclaiming the Spanish Language, which really inspired this show. Thanks for joining us, Karen.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Veronica Benavides, who is the founder and CEO of the Language Preservation Project, which is a movement to reverse the trend of language loss across the generations. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Karen, let's start with you. How do you, or how do the academics and other people who work in this field, how do they define, like, quote unquote, heritage language?
Heritage language is actually a term that I learned from Veronica, and she shared with me that it's the language spoken in the home that's different from the dominant language in the country. So for me, my heritage language, my first language is English, but my heritage language is Spanish. I would describe it as in the background, how my parents talk to each other, to family, to neighbors.
Mm-hmm. And did you feel comfortable in your Spanish as you grew up?
Not at all, and I still don't. I'm still very self-conscious in spaces with fluent Spanish speakers. But it's English is my first language because my parents are both immigrants from different parts of Mexico. But when my mom came to the US when she was a little girl, she attended elementary school here and was often reprimanded for saying a phrase or talking in Spanish with a classmate. And that was just kind of one of the influences that made her decide she was going to teach her children English. And myself and my siblings, we are English speakers first.
Veronica, I mean, my experience is a little bit different from this in that, you know, my dad is Mexican, my mom's from New England, but I was born in Mexico and stayed there till I was three, like I was saying. So when we came back, my sister was actually seven, I was three, but we didn't keep going with Spanish. So would we be considered heritage language learners? I mean, we would hear Spanish from my dad sometimes, but it wasn't like the dominant language that was spoken in our home.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think there are a lot of different academic definitions for what a heritage language is. We at the Language Preservation Project also like to use the term children with bilingualism in their bones, which really reflects this concept that we have a lineage that connects us back to cultural and linguistic assets that are not the dominant linguistic and cultural assets of the society that we're in. And so even if it's through, you know, we grew up in a home or in a community that, you know, didn't speak the heritage language, but through second, third, fourth, you know, generations ago that was there, I would still consider that a heritage language. And I think that's really important to view that as valid because it's these heritage languages are lost often not at kind of a personal failure level, but because of systemic pressures and systems. And so that's really an important realization in terms of coming back to our heritage language and feeling the permission to take up that space.
We're talking about reclaiming your heritage language with Veronica Benavides, who's the founder and CEO of the Language Preservation Project, and the LA Times' Karen Garcia. I love this phrase that Veronica just used, which is children with bilingualism in their bones. Are you one of those people? Do your family have another language aside from English that has been spoken around you or that you've wanted to speak or that your ancestors spoke? Give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786. Could be any language. Doesn't have to be Spanish. Number is 866-733-6786. Also, kind of scary, shame-filled space. I promise we're going to be nice to you. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, we're KQED Forum. And the email is forum@kqed.org. Karen, I wanted to ask you about how you went about. Have you made a few runs at trying to learn Spanish? This is kind of how I feel. Like you kind of go at it, fail a little bit, try and go at it again. Is that what you've done, or have you been very consistent?
I mean, I think that really it was in my adult life that I made it a point to have conversations with my parents. I didn't go that far away for school, maybe like 3 hours away. So talking on the phone with them, in the last few years, I downloaded Duolingo. But I think that,
Same, same. Yeah.
yeah. And I've also recently just put myself on the wait list for Spanish Sintena, which is an amazing organization founded by women. And they created just an amazing safe space to learn at your own pace, and also to have meetups virtually and now in person. And it's a space where not again, not only you learn, but you're in a vulnerable place where other people are also vulnerable learning along with you. Probably have the same shared experience, probably also have felt shame. So I'm on that list. But I think my most treasured practice is my dad and I go to every other Sunday, we go to a supermarket together in Wilmington, California, and we meet at 8 a.m. We drive over there together. We just buy produce and we talk. We talk about family stuff, current events, work, whatever it is. But when I make a mistake or when I can't remember what word I want to use, his corrections are very patient and they're very encouraging. And
What's
that is
that
super.
like?
Oh, man, it's great. I can tell you because I've also experienced a family member tell me that you know, you're never going to speak Spanish correctly, so you might as well just forget about it, give it up. So being able to be in that like 2 2.5 hour space with my dad is everything, because it makes me want to keep practicing. It makes me want to continue having these conversations in Spanish, even if my Spanish is Spanglish, or if I need prompts or reminders for a word or a phrase. It's everything. And I think that's exactly the validation and the work Veronica does, and also the work that Spanish Sin Pena does. Finding those spaces is the motivation to help people practice or keep it going for whatever the reasons are.
I just wanted to note that resource that Karen Garcia was just mentioning was called Spanish Sin Pena. Veronica Benavides, how about your experience around heritage language learning? Did you come up just kind of speaking fluently and easily with your family, or have you had to recapture some of this as an adult as well?
Absolutely not. I did not come out speaking Spanish easily and fluently. No, well, I think similar to a lot of Latinos in the US, my parents grew up in South Texas, in the Rio Grande Valley, speaking only Spanish. They were the first in their families to go to any type of school, and they went to school just speaking Spanish, and were pretty quickly met with English only environment. And environments that punished them, that ridiculed them when they were speaking Spanish. And so they learned that Spanish was not something that would support academic, achievement, or would support upward mobility. And I think those messages of, assimilation can also be reframed as messages of survival, right? Of like how our communities have adapted in order to survive in this society. And those messages were passed down to me. And we didn't grow up speaking Spanish. My parents used it around us, like when they didn't want us to understand what was going on, like sometimes would try to get us to speak Spanish to say, like, try to order this food in Spanish, which I think was the extent of what we could do. But I really was surrounded by it in a lot of ways. My community was very Latino. My grandma only spoke Spanish. And I think similar also to maybe a lot of folks who are heritage language speakers, I attempted to learn Spanish many times. Like I had this desire to learn it, which is what you need for any type of learning, not just language learning. You need motivation. But what was stronger than my motivation was my shame. And so I couldn't get over that fear of pronouncing something wrong. I couldn't get over that fear of not living up to my identity or expectations around that. So that, made me be silent or not really be able to engage in language learning in the way that maybe somebody who doesn't really have that connection to their culture, to that culture, or who doesn't really owe anything to that language, they can dive in and say, like, whatever, I'm just,
Look how
learning
good
this
I
language.
am. Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I think, that is what really helped me to understand that heritage language learning is different than just language learning. And it requires a different approach, and it requires a culturally responsive approach, but also recognizing like the historical traumas that our societies, that our communities have been through, not only with folks who speak Spanish, but folks who speak, Mayan or other indigenous languages, or who speak, Farsi or whatever these cultural linguistic resources are that they received either through, outright violence or through more subtle messages that those weren't strengths and assets. And so it was really coming to that realization that I was able to unlock the language. And it was when I became a mother that I had my son, and I was like, okay, am I going to pass on my liberation or am I going to pass on my oppression to my kid? And it was really a lot of intentional thinking about, like, I want him to feel that it's okay to be a learner. It's okay to have mistakes. It's okay to speak a language for connection and not perfection. And so that really was kind of my approach and entry into this work.
Preach, Veronica. I love hearing all of that. And we're going to talk a lot more about kids when we come back. We're talking about reclaiming your heritage language with Veronica Benavides, who's the founder and CEO of the Language Preservation Project, and the LA Times, Karen Garcia. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking about reclaiming heritage languages, the languages that have been spoken by, you know, some of your ancestors, but that perhaps you didn't totally get down fluently. We're joined by Karen Garcia, a reporter on the utility journalism team at the Los Angeles Times. She's the author of a great and very comprehensive recent article that's about how second and third generation Latinos are reclaiming Spanish, even if they didn't grow up speaking it perfectly. We're also joined by Veronica Benavides, who's the founder and CEO of the Language Preservation Project, a movement to reverse the trend of language loss across the generations. We'd love to hear from you. Are you a child with bilingualism in your bones, as Veronica might put it? Or what about maybe you're a parent who would like to pass on a language to your children, but aren't sure how to do it or how to keep them speaking, you know, Vietnamese or Cantonese? You can give us a call. The number's 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, we're KQED Forum. And the email is forum@kqed.org. If you write a really good email, I promise I'm going to cry reading it on the air. So let's fire up the emails. Let's bring in our first caller, Chloe in San Jose. Welcome.
Yeah, hi, Alexis. Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
So, so my husband and I moved to the U.S. about 10 years ago. We're both from France, so we do both speak French, and we have two kids. So one boy who's 3 years old and a girl who's going to be 8 years old soon. And at home, we chose to only speak in French because we thought that, you know, we wouldn't be the best people to teach them English because our English is okay, but, you know, we have kind of a strong accent. And so we thought that, you know, we can teach them to speak French. So they do both speak French pretty well. I mean, you wouldn't feel or see the difference between, you know, my girl's cousins. So they do both speak really good French, and they speak French to their grandparents and the family, and we do try to, like, you know, travel to France every year, so they do get some part of the culture, and they do, you know, do a lot of activities with, like, other kids who speak French. But, yeah, we really chose to separate what we speak at home and what we speak what they speak in school. Mm.
Quick question. Are you planning on sending them to some, you know, one of the écoles that where they would continue, you know, learning in French, or are they just going to, you know, standard American schools where they're English all day?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So we've asked ourselves that question because I think at some point my husband wants to go back to France, and the education in France is very different than the education in the U.S. But to be honest, those French schools in the Bay Area, they are very expensive. Mm-hmm. So we're like, you know, maybe not. But for my daughter, we do have a tutor. She's just great. She used to be a director in France. And so my daughter has 2 hours a week where she actually learned how to write in French, which is very hard, to be honest. Yeah. So she can speak very good French, but for the part where she needs to read and write, that we have a tutor who does that very well.
Yeah. Hey, Chloe, thank you so much for that, you know, testimonial. For me, because I did have, like you were saying, Veronica, I did have so much shame around not speaking Spanish perfectly. All I cared about with my kids' early education was that they were speaking Spanish. So they've been going to EBI in Oakland, which happens to be very close to our house. And one of the things, Veronica, that I wanted to ask you about is I've noticed among the school community, there's a lot of people who are like my parents, where like one of the people is like a native Spanish speaker and the other person is not. And it just seems like it's extremely difficult in that kind of circumstance to really keep it going for the kids. Do you have any tips maybe for parents who might be in that kind of situation?
Yeah, I totally hear that a lot. I've seen a lot of situations like that. I think it's really important to have a plan for bilingualism. Just like, you know, people talk about, you know, what are different approaches to like raising our kids? There should be a discussion around like different approaches to raising a bilingual child, because it is an effort in order to do that, especially if you don't have access to bilingual schools. It can make it even more difficult, but it's still possible. In our home, we have three different languages. We have Danish, my partner's Danish, Spanish, and English. Mm. And there are so many different strategies that you can use based on your family structure in order to help with the development of languages. There are different strategies like one parent, one language, where one parent will speak that language no matter what. There could be like a time and place, like, okay, well, we speak Spanish just at dinner together. There could be, you know, situational Spanish where you speak, you know, your heritage language in different situations. So there's lots of different strategies to meet different levels of fluency and family structures. What we help families in our program determine is like, what is that plan for your family? Mm-hmm. How mm-hmm. will it change over time? It might look different when your kids are a lot younger. It might look different when they get to the middle years and the older years. And then how do you make sure, especially if you're in a situation where one person, there's only one person in the family that's a heritage language learner or a heritage language speaker, that they don't carry that burden all on themselves, that it is viewed as a family project that includes not only, you know, folks in your immediate family, but also in your extended family and community to ensure that you're, you know, you're approaching it in a really comprehensive way.
Mm. Karen, I wanted to ask you, at least in my case, it took me a little while. It actually took me until I saw all these other parents struggling to teach their kids Spanish for me to really kind of truly forgive my parents for not sort of making me speak Spanish. I would see all these people just speaking so effortlessly, and I would have been like, all you had to do was talk to me and I would be like that. Did you have any of those feelings where you were sort of, you know, had some anger or even just kind of some grumbles about the fact that, you know, you didn't come up fluent?
I think that for me, to be honest, I didn't have any grumbles. Mm-hmm. I think I understood that the decisions that my parents made, more so the decision that my mom made, was out of an act of survival and was out of an act of wanting her children to be successful or her children to be accepted in society or in societal spaces. So I think that for me, and this might not be any, something that other people agree with or have felt, because I feel that even though we all have these shared experiences of language loss, heritage language loss, everybody feels it differently. And for me, I don't. For me, I understand. Sometimes I wish, like, I wish you just would have had a few more conversations with me, but I definitely understand. I think a lot of people in this field that either study or support or have programs or organizations to support people that want to reclaim the language now or relearn the language now, it's almost like not forgiving, but it's understood. What happened is understood. And it's also understood if you feel upset or if you feel sad or if you feel like you wanted more. It's a very forgiving community, I think.
One listener writes in, I'm biracial, Black and Mexican from California. And when I lived in D.C. for college, a man asked me for directions in Spanish. When I explained I would do my best as I don't consider myself fluent, he basically said, I'm so sorry. I thought you were Latina. When I tried to say that I am, I just don't know the language fluently, he just repeated the same thing. It was the first time I felt kind of shoved out because of not being brought up knowing the language. My father did not want to teach us Spanish because he forgot so much since the schools and children's homes he was sent to back in the 1940s did not allow him to speak Spanish. Over the years, he forgot a lot, and he wanted us to learn it properly in school. I learned a lot in school, but now I want to learn more, but it's so hard to find affordable classes. And we're in California. It shouldn't be this hard. My one tip there is the community college classes are very cheap. And that's thank you for that note. Let's go to Jason in Piedmont. Welcome, Jason.
Hi there. This is Jason Villaluz. I grew up in Connecticut, and both my parents were doctors, and they had Filipino doctors, and they had recently passed away. And I find myself missing them so much. So the only way I've been trying to reconnect with my language is watching YouTube videos and, that to say, TikToks of these Filipino language speakers that try to help you enunciate. And occasionally I will try when I go to Seafood City and the various Filipino districts, try to reconnect with them and try to like have casual conversations with those elderly Filipinos.
Yeah. How is it working?
Extremely bad. I mean, really, really bad. I just not getting the tones right. And, you know, I'm still trying, though.
Yeah. You know, Jason, I appreciate that. I mean, there is something about failing in your heritage language that I think people have, you know, if you're coming to language from the outside, you just don't feel it in quite the same way. And I feel like if I have that kind of interaction where I miss on Spanish with someone I'd really like to talk to and connect with, and then find myself blanked, I'll think about that for like 3 weeks. So, Veronica, I again come back to you for like a strategy. I feel like, I don't know, do I need breathing exercises? Like, what are the things that can be done to actually help you kind of push? Because we all know you're going to need to sound bad, silly, incorrect, trying to speak any other language. So for people who, yeah, like us, like me and Jason, who are in this situation, and you're staring at someone blankly who just asked you something in very fast Spanish or Tagalog, what do we do to sort of calm ourselves and stay in the fight of learning the language?
Yeah, I mean, such a great question. And I've definitely been there. I would say breathing exercises are great for any situation. I think that is definitely an approach here. You know, in the moment, instances where you feel like you can't respond, I would say just be really gentle and kind with yourself and not be too hard on yourself. I think it's really important to understand that like stress and shame blocks learning and communication. So really trying to like ground yourself and also not apologize for not speaking your heritage language. Like that, you know, if someone tries to make you feel shame about that, that's their problem and not yours. And that's, you know, perpetuating this idea that actually when colonizers were stripping communities away from their language, they did that because they wanted to weaken the ties within the communities. So if we internally are perpetuating that by saying, you don't belong to us because you don't speak our language, then we're perpetuating this colonialistic thought that is just separating us from our humanity. Mm. So if you encounter someone doing that, you know,
but Veronica, what if the person making me feel shame is me? You know, it's like the Spider-Man meme. You know, yeah. That's I think what I struggle with. Dale has a really interesting question. Dale in San Francisco, welcome.
Hello, hi. I wanted to share my thoughts on it. I'm an American that had high school Spanish, was living in Mexico, rural Mexico. Got up to speed there. Then I met a Chilean woman in Mexico who'd been, you know, working in tourism there. So she was speaking a very international Spanish. We began a relationship and then got married and have a child. We started and immediately my wife's language we became a family. Her Spanish switched to Chilean Spanish as her family was more part of our family. And so there was a period where I couldn't understand their Spanish, because it was different than the Spanish that I learned. Then as we moved to San Francisco, our family language kind of became a really strong Spanish or Spanglish because of all the mixing. Suddenly our Spanish speaking family was living in San Francisco. And so we were speaking much more English, and then there became lots of play, and we had a child. So there was lots of play with the language and funny words. Now our daughter is starting high school and my wife is getting her master's in her second language, English. And my daughter is starting high school and studying in Spanish 1 because she wants to relearn it from the ground up. Mm. But more than anything, I would just say it's important to have the curiosity and the playfulness with it for mm-hmm. the languages, because they are so fluid.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of ways to speak. There's a lot of ways to speak Spanish. I mean, it's funny now, my daughter comes home with the ways that her Spanish raised teacher, you know, from Madrid speaking teacher is studying Spanish or teaching Spanish. And then my daughter having a mother that's Chilean, and they have almost a different vocabulary sometimes.
I mean, one thing that thank you for that, Dale. I mean, one thing that has been really clear at Escuela Bilingüe, where my kids go to school, is just, man, so many different types of Spanish, so many different ways of speaking. And it's amazing, because when I'm talking with people from Central Mexico or in Central Mexico, I do feel like I understand it a little bit more, because that's the sort of Spanish that I grew up around. We have a couple amazing comments I want to read. First up, we've got Hannah writes in to say, I hold a lot of guilt for only speaking Spanish and a lot of disappointment that my parents didn't teach me our heritage language. But I've realized that language loss was common with our history of migration and war. During the Khmer Rouge genocide, my mother's father forbid his children to speak their Chinese dialect and only speak Khmer to guarantee survival. I know my mother also holds a lot of guilt for not knowing their Chinese dialect anymore, so we're both on our journeys to learn and embrace our home culture in other ways, like celebrating traditional holidays or visiting the Buddhist temples. It's actually been a nice way for my mother and I to bond as we've grown older. Victoria tweets, so proud of my daughter and her spot-on accent, but Veronica, I thank you for making me think about how I might approach learning Spanish formally without my own baggage. And Pierre writes in to say, I grew up in a French-speaking household in suburban New Jersey. I understand okay, but I'm far from fluent, and I consider myself functionally illiterate. The most interesting thing is that people are surprised and even disappointed that I'm not fluent when they hear my name, Pierre. As you can hear, this is an extremely common process here in the U.S. Karen, as you were reporting this out, were you able to like get any sense of like how widespread, particularly for this kind of second and third generation folks, how widespread is it, this like desire to try and reclaim a heritage language?
I mean, anecdotally, it just, everyone that I've interviewed for the story, several people that didn't make it into the story that wanted to just share their personal experiences, whether it was Spanish from learning from their parents from Mexico or a different part of South America. It is most definitely a shared experience. Everyone has a unique part of it or history of it or parents' reasoning for it, but it is very much widespread, and it's not just the Latino community. And Veronica, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it is a shared experience between immigrant communities, immigrant mm-hmm. populations, and people that have come to the U.S. and have assimilated or have felt that they needed to be successful here, and this is how, and letting go of a part of their culture, of their identity, of their person, and this is kind of the result of that, of now a new generation of people that say, wait, you know, this is a part of me, this is a part of our family, and we should be proud of it, we should celebrate it, we shouldn't want to let it go or trade it in for anything else.
Yeah, I feel like it's practically a defining second generation experience to talk about and try to reclaim your heritage language as best you can. We're talking about heritage languages, reclaiming them with Karen Garcia, who's a reporter on the utility journalism team with the Los Angeles Times, Veronica Benavides, who's the founder and CEO of the Language Preservation Project, and of course, we're talking with all of you about your own stories. You can give us a call about trying to reclaim your heritage language or pass it on to your kids. The number is 866-733-6786. I'm loving these emails. Forum@kqed.org. Stay tuned for more. Welcome back to Forum. We're talking about reclaiming your heritage language, language that you're ancestors may have spoken, with Karen Garcia, reporter on the utility journalism team at the Los Angeles Times, whose recent article, How Second and Third Generation Latinos Are Reclaiming the Spanish Language, really inspired this show. We're also joined by Veronica Benavides, who's the founder and CEO of the Language Preservation Project, which is a movement to reverse the trend of language loss across the generations. Relevant to this, she's also a doctor of education from Harvard. We also are joined by Ki Sung, who is managing editor of digital news here at KQED. Welcome, Ki.
Hi, Alexis.
So Ki is here because last week we were talking about this very thing, And I learned that Ki is actually every Saturday morning, or maybe not every Saturday mornings. Ki, what do you do with your weekend?
Every Saturday morning, around 7 a.m., I join a Zoom class to learn Korean. And I realize in just thinking about this experience, I've been doing this for in some capacity for about 20 years, not necessarily on Zoom, but spending Saturday mornings trying to get better at my heritage language, which is Korean.
Wow. And I mean, talk to me about your relationship with it. I mean, that's like an incredible amount of motivation. In fact, I'm feeling guilt and shame just hearing you describe that. How far do you think you've gotten with it? How do you feel about your relationship to it now?
I do what I can, you know. I mean, I like everyone has talked about in this hour, there is this want for perfection and definitely shame. But, you know, I do what I can. And one quote, I just want to share a quote that I learned maybe like, I don't know, six years ago that really helped shape these feelings we have about shame. And this is from Rick Hansen. He's a psychologist at UC Berkeley of the Greater Good Science Center. And he said, we have a brain that's like Velcro for bad and Teflon for good. And I think about all those stumbles where, you know, like I couldn't, a Korean speaker couldn't understand me, or all those terrible moments. But I also try to savor more of the good moments, like the times that I was watching a K-drama and I understood what people were saying without having to read the subtitles. Mm. Or the times I was able to text my dad in Korean, something that would have been unheard of, you know, I don't know, in the past. And so I've been a language learner for about 20 years. With deliberate effort and, you know, not like Saturday mornings for the entire 20 years, but really where I can do it. You know, there's some years where I go without taking classes. There's some years where I go, you know, I don't know, 3 months out of the year. But I try to do what I can because I think that's I'm trying to just do what's available mm-hmm. to me at yeah. the moment.
Have you noticed any difference for the people in your classes? I mean, as Korean culture has exploded across the world and we have K-pop and we have K-dramas and everybody's interested in Korean culture now, have you noticed any difference between people who are taking it just because, you know, they really love BTS and people who are taking it as heritage learners?
There are a ton of all of us, I think it turns out, in every class, there's usually a mix of heritage learners or heritage speakers who are trying to, you know, reclaim their language. And then also a lot of K-pop stans and who are actually incredibly fluent. I mean, I hear them speak. I can literally close my eyes and like not think about the fact that they're not Korean. There are people in my class who've also never been to Korea, but actually speak really well. And in many ways, it's inspiring because it shows that with enough practice, with enough exposure, like I can be like that person who maybe doesn't have the shame and the guilt that might get in the way of even taking that step to learn language. But, you know, to see like how far you can go if you spend the time and have the resources to learn.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to go back to the phones in a second. But Ki Sung, thank you so much for joining us, sharing this experience. Actually, I think there's quite a few of us at KQED who are in this position. Ki Sung, managing editor of digital news at KQED and really excellent heritage language learner.
Keep trying. Never give up.
Never give up. Thank you, Ki. Veronica, you know, one of the things that I've struggled with is the sense of it, I'm air quoting here, it being in there, and the it in this case being Spanish, and that I kept thinking, like, well, if I just, like, listen to some Spanish podcasts or I immerse myself for a bit or I do some Duolingo, somehow, like, those early language roots of, like, having, you know, learned Spanish as a little baby would, like, magically spring back to life. And when that didn't happen, I'd get so frustrated. Have you had any experience with that, where people sort of expect themselves to be better than someone who's coming to the language fresh would be?
Yeah, I mean, I think we often are better than what we imagine. So I think when we are speaking a language, and we, like he said, we focus on like the negative things or the things that we're messing up and not necessarily the positive. And this is really a mindset shift that I've had to have because I want to pass that on to my children, and also it really facilitated my language learning, is to look at it from a strength-based perspective. So I think for a long time, I know this wasn't Karen's experience, but this was my experience, that I was like, you know, my parents should have taught me Spanish. Like, why didn't they teach me Spanish? Mm-hmm. And then when I had my firstborn, I realized, like, okay, my parents did what they could, and what they gave me was better than nothing. And that was a foundation that allowed me, that gave me some leeway to access this language in a different way, and looking at those strengths. And whatever I pass on to my son is going to be better than nothing, even if it isn't 100% or if he can't, you know, write a college essay in that language. And so I think with that, it being in there, it is in there in some form or another. Maybe it's not full fluency, but maybe it's a connection to the language. Maybe it's a motivation. Maybe it's some ability to have an ear for the accent, or you're a passive bilingual where you understand it. And so it's really important to take that strength-based perspective and to operate from a perspective of enoughness rather than a deficit-based perspective.
Yeah, I love that. Give us a little extra motivation. Our producer, Blanca Torres, got a cut of her 6-year-old Lucero Aldana, daughter of one of our producers. She attends a dual immersion school in the East Bay, and she's talking about why she wants to speak two languages.
Yo me llamo Lucero Aldana.
¿Te gusta leer en inglés y en español?
Sí.
¿Por qué? ¿Te gusta hablar dos idiomas?
Sí.
Why do you like speaking two languages?
Because I like to learn and I want to know two languages.
Who are you going to talk to in two languages?
My grandma and my grandpa and my other grandma.
I love that. Lucero Aldana joining us this morning. Thank you so much for doing that, Blanca. Ron also wants to note another issue here, an adjacent issue and one we should do a whole other show on. Ron writes, the issue of a heritage language is not only an immigrant issue. For those of us who are First Nation citizens, many of our languages have disappeared under the onslaught of English only and acculturation. For those of us fortunate enough to have excellent languages, the number of fluent speakers continues to decline, and with the loss of each first language-speaking elder, we lose a universe. I've been studying my own language for years, and it is only recently that I've been able to participate in a conversation. We must preserve Indigenous languages, and each of us has a responsibility to give it our best. Acquiring a second or third or fourth language is not antithetical to learning the common national language. For us, it is critical to cultural survival. Really good message there. Another listener had wanted to note that the process of losing language began centuries ago in Latin America when Spanish replaced indigenous languages. I wouldn't say totally replaced, but at least became the dominant language of the area of the world. Sadly, many indigenous languages in Mexico are in jeopardy of being lost forever, and that family is trying to relearn their ancestral language. Let's bring in Adam here. Adam in San Francisco.
Hi. Hi. Yeah. Hi. I'm here.
Great. Go ahead.
So I was calling because this is also a very interesting and kind of hits home subject for me. And it's the first time calling in. So I'm kind of excited.
Hey, welcome. But, welcome.
Thank you. I was calling because, so my heritage is Assyrian. It's a old Mesopotamian heritage. My parents are born in Iran and I was first generation American. They spoke to me in Assyrian and English growing up. And then when we got to school, the schools at the time were telling the parents to basically only speak English at home because they didn't want to waste time teaching us English in school so that we wouldn't be far behind other students in our classes. My question is kind of along the lines of what is the kind of status quo these days? Like what do schools, are schools encouraging kids to, or parents to continue speaking that language at home so that they do grow up bilingual, or are they discouraging it still like they did with us? And like, cause that was, you know, that kills a lot. This is a hard language to learn. You have to basically find an Assyrian church that has elders that will teach it in classes that are like, you know, Sunday school kind of class. Mm. It's not a Duolingo or Babbel kind of language. So it's very hard for me to ever find it again. There's some passive understanding I have, but I've also recently just lost my grandparents who were the main speakers and the main reasons of speaking in the family. Now they're gone. So English is kind of, you know, the predominant thing now, but it takes away from who we actually are, you know, because we are. Yeah.
Do you feel that as like a loss?
I do. There was a lot of missed opportunity of being able to get more communication with my grandparents growing up. They knew English a little bit, but not so well that they could, like, you know, tell me these long, cool stories about their lives or what it was like living in Iran and why they left. And, you know, like, I get the stories from my parents, so they can tell me these things, but it's not the same when it's not, you know, from them. And so there was always limited communication with them growing up. So as much as I love them and love to be with them, it could have been, you know, there could have been such a bigger relationship there, you know?
Yeah. Adam, thanks so much for sharing that experience. And yeah, I sometimes forget with Spanish how easy I actually have it, you know, that there are many languages. It's just much more difficult to access those kinds of resources. You know, one listener writes in to say, this is for parents where one or both parents refuse to speak their native language, even if for reasons that are understandable. Colon, speak it. You will give your children a bilingual advantage that could help with travel and jobs. My parents are German and Austrian, both escaped the Holocaust. My father refused to speak German, so I did not grow up speaking German. I will at some point study it because I would like to learn it, but it would have been great to grow up bilingual. Liza writes in to say, I'm ethnically Chinese, born and raised in Peru until we moved to San Francisco when I was just short of 11 years old. My first language was Cantonese, followed by Spanish, followed by English. However, my English is better than my Spanish, which is better than my Cantonese. My son is in an English-Spanish bilingual class at school. He goes to Saturday Chinese school, but it's a struggle. My question is, how do you get children to appreciate heritage language they're willing to learn? I'm sure he'll appreciate when he's older, but he's not appreciating it at 7 years old. Man, do I feel that. We are in a pledge period here at KQED, so head on over to the pledge. We want you to support. Thanks so much. And back to the show. You know, when you have these people who are multilingual, Veronica, I wanted you to maybe sort of address them. It feels like an embarrassment of riches to me, honestly, that you might have multiple languages spoken in the home. Can you talk to me about if there are specific difficulties that people might be wanting to think about?
Do you mean specific difficulties as a multilingual person?
As a multilingual household, as opposed to a bilingual household. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, we have a multilingual household. And I think there can be like communication errors, right? Like if everybody doesn't speak the same language, so my husband speaks Danish, but I don't speak Danish, and I speak Spanish, but he doesn't speak Spanish. So I think that can deter some people from using those heritage languages and passing them on to the kids, because they're like, well, we just want everybody to be on the same page, so we'll just speak English. But I think you have to be kind of extra communicative about what you're doing, what you're saying, maybe saying it in Spanish to your child and then repeating it in English so your, you know, partner can understand. So I think there are a lot of challenges in that way. I think there can be the challenge that you think just because you speak the language that your child will then absorb it.
Right.
And language learning doesn't happen through osmosis. There has to be some real intentionality behind it. And I think most importantly, what we work with folks to understand is that, like, you really, more than anything, want to develop a positive relationship to the language, because even if your child maybe speaks it up until six and then takes a break, maybe then they'll come back to it at 12. But really understanding and knowing the damage that shame and like met expectations can do to language learning is something that you want to avoid, and really keep it as something that is not based in terms of what, you know, what would happen if they don't do it, but, you know, what could be preserved if they could. Mm.
Let's bring in Claire in Alameda. Welcome, Claire.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I had a couple comments. My daughter studied linguistics, and that was her major, and her final paper was on language loss and how that affects mental health. And brings up like depression and so forth. And I come from a family that's got a lot of Spanish speaking folks and Italian and of course English speaking, and we all got together at Christmas time, and my brother was joking that the language that was being spoken was Spanglishiano. There is like a strong drive for all of us to speak and learn our heritage languages. And, you know, I unfortunately wasn't taught Italian growing up because my aunt, when she went to school and only spoke Italian, was teased, I guess mercilessly. And so they stopped speaking Italian in the home. And I feel the same kind of loss a lot of other callers have been talking about, of not having that language and wishing that it'd be so much easier.
Yeah, right? I know. We all think about it. I know. Thank you so much, Claire, for sharing that. We have a couple of great comments that I want to get to. Michelle writes in to say, I'm mixed race, Tejana Mexican on my mom's side and white, mostly Irish on my dad's side. I grew up with a white name outside the house and a strong Latina grandmother in the house. She wanted my sister and I to achieve the dignity and status that she knew was just out of reach for her as a Tejana Mexican American. Part of this was not speaking Spanish to us. She spoke it to my mother, especially when there was something that needed to be said about my father that she did not want us to hear. But she made it clear to us through her actions that speaking Spanish was not going to help us. I'll never forget her telling me, "You're half white. You're almost there." Oof. What was confusing is at the same time, she was the strongest and toughest Chola you've ever met. Another story coming in. Veronique writes, both my parents are Arabic speakers, but they didn't want to teach us the language because they wanted us to integrate well into French society. We ended up learning all the bad words. But I ended up reproducing this with my own kids with my French language because my husband is an English speaker and it's hard to keep up with teaching a language. They're complaining now, but I remind them that they didn't want to make the effort either when I read to them in French and refused to listen to it. It's really an effort parents and kids have to make to teach and learn a language together. Last comment, Gary writes, I sometimes notice this interesting dynamic from people in terms of their expectations regarding a heritage language based on if you look like you should be able to speak the language or not. So sometimes there's an expectation that one should be able to speak the language or don't speak it fluently. Then it's met with sadness, disappointment, or letdown. And when someone outside the ethnic or cultural group can speak the language, they're met with, wow, that's great. Yeah, I have seen that many times. Thank you so much. We've been talking about reclaiming your heritage language with Karen Garcia of the Los Angeles Times, whose recent article inspired this show. Thanks for joining us, Karen.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've also been joined by Veronica Benavides, founder and CEO of the Language Preservation Project. Thanks for joining us, Veronica.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Alexis Madrigal. This is the amazing song Salta. Thanks so much for all your calls and comments and sharing this pain all together. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum Ahead with Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
Thanks again to KQED's Forum for sharing this episode with us. Don't forget to follow and subscribe to them on your favorite platforms. Thank you so much for tuning in today. If you love what you heard, take a minute to share this podcast with a friend or colleague. Your ratings and reviews help us to keep this podcast going. We love hearing from you. You can email us at hello@thelanguageproject.co or slide into our DMs on Instagram @talkingtograndma. Talking to Grandma is owned by the Language Preservation Project. Rebecca De Leon is our editor and producer. The artwork for Talking to Grandma was created by Nancy Guevara, and I'm your host, Dr. Veronica Benavides.